in the context of what's going on today, one of the most common, and it's a very profound question that comes up in halacha, is the question of payment. You hire somebody to perform perhaps in an event, you hire somebody who's your employee and you're his employer. You may even have to pay your employer even though he's not doing any work. You hire a teacher, a tutor, or you pay tuition in a school. The school is not providing much. And the question is, are you still contractually bound to pay those monies? And this question comes up all the time in our days, and it takes on different shapes and different forms. I'm going to use today as a testing ground to see if this topic goes, if it flies well with you, with me, if we're able to begin to get a grasp on some of the fundamental halachic issues. I want to welcome Joe Zeifman, who just joined us. And I'll start with the following introduction. The world, to some extent, and I'm not necessarily including Canada, every country is a little different. Canada probably would not fit this description, but to some extent, many countries will admit that Corona, at least at some point, has frozen the world, and people are quarantined, they're living in their homes for long weeks. Many of the Torah institutions are no longer functional. Summer camps have been canceled. All sorts of events that should have taken place in wedding halls and other halls have been canceled. Photographers have been claiming that they're virtually out of work, except for a local wedding. Sometimes they can do some work. So besides catering halls and schools, many workers are finding themselves unable to provide the services that they normally would provide. And here we have two issues, or maybe it's one, shtaim sheinachas, two facets of one issue. One is the claim of the hired worker who says, look, there's circumstances beyond my control. It's not like I'm a lazy bones. I can't provide the services because it's impossible to do so. You know, if the school was closed down by the Ministry of Health, I can't teach. That's not my fault. I'm ready and eager to provide those services. The counterclaim is, well, you know what? I contractually obligated myself to pay you. I hired you. But the premise upon which that contract was based, was predicated on, is that you will provide services for me. And through no circumstances that you can be responsible for, but nevertheless, you're not providing those services. Do I have to provide and pay for services that are not rendered simply because we entered into a contractual agreement? That contractual agreement should be null and void. Okay. So this is just by way of introduction to the shiur I want to give to you today. I'm not sure. I'm a little bit confused about what texts you received and what you did not. The text that I'm most interested in comes from a journal called Omek Hapshat. I mentioned it last week when we were talking about walking into a hospital, knowing full well they're going to take your temperature on the way in, and that might entail a violation of the Shabbos. And there's a lot more to discuss, by the way, new tshuvas that came out on that topic, especially whether or not a person is allowed to take a test for Corona on Friday, knowing full well that the labs will violate the Shabbos just 24 hours later on Shabbos in order to get the results of that test. And many people will subject themselves, will come. Here we have different stations for these tests, and it's not only in hospitals, but it's even outdoor tests and so forth. And the question is, are you causing Jews to violate the Shabbos? But that is going to be for another time. Now again, the one that I tried to send to you, I don't know if you received it, is Gilio number 265. And it might pay for you to write that down, 265, so that, God willing, we could take a look if this experiment works at 266 and then 267. They form a unit that deal with the many branches and the many manifestations, if you will, of this basic fundamental question. The story begins from a halachic perspective, of course, in the Talmud, and in this case in Masechta Bava Metzia, which dedicates an entire parak called Socheres HaPoalim, You Hired Workers. The sugya at the beginning of the parak deals with issues like, can the Poalim decide that they want to quit middle of the day, and now the employer is stuck trying to find someone to finish the job that's already been started and it's midday. And there are many, many other dimensions of that sugya. But if we fast forward to page Kuf Hey, which is the equivalent of 105, and we're on the second side, that's where the story really is addressed.
What text are you using?
Again, I there was some mix-up, I don't know. I thought I gave clear instructions, but apparently my instructions were not good. You were meant to get something called Omek HaPshat, which looks like this, and I apologize, I don't know what went wrong. You may have gotten some materials from Rav Schechter, which we probably won't get to today.
But I'm not registered with you anyhow.
Oh, so now...
This is my first time listening.
Oh, so now I got to get you registered with my favorite fellow, David Spiegel. Let's see. If you can send me an email, and I'll just pass it on to David Spiegel. My email address is azariaberzon@gmail.com.
Okay.
And we'll get you on the list so that you can get to Mara Mekomos.
Okay.
In the case of today, as far as today's shiur, I don't think you're at much of a disadvantage because...
I'm happy to listen.
Yeah, because I think, Harry, what happens is none of us, except for me, have the text in front of them.
Okay.
Again, if you go on to a site called Beinenu, you can just simply pull this out, but I don't know if we're going to do that right now. So let me give you a little bit of background here to what I consider the most important text of our discussion for today. And that is Bava Metzia Kuf Hey Amud Beis. Now, there's no way we can even begin this discussion and hope for success unless you write down two words on your page. And that's a disadvantage of a shiur in Zoom, because my technological skills are very limited, and I don't have... Again, I know that Zoom provides this, but I don't know technologically how to do this and create a kind of a whiteboard for you. So if you can take the time and get yourself a pen and paper, write down these two words, Maskir and Socher. Because without those two words, it ain't gonna fly. As we say in baseball, you won't even get to first base. Maskir and Socher. Now, let's define those two terms. The Maskir provides a service. and he demands payment for that service. A contract is signed between the maskir who's providing the service and the socher who's receiving the service. Now what happens, and this is the subject of the sugya bab metzia, if the socher who's meant to receive the services is no longer receiving the services? The maskir who's meant to provide the services is claiming that due to circumstances beyond his control, he's not capable of providing those services. I'll give you the case in the Gemara in just a moment, but let me first reduce it to a very simple case. A maskir es hachamar. I rent you a donkey. I'm the maskir. I'm providing you with a service. Umeis hachamar. And the chamar dies. The socher in this case says to the maskir, look, my friend, I don't want to pay you rental fees for a dead animal. I can't use it. I can't benefit from it. You're not providing me with the services. The maskir turns to the socher and he says, but wait a minute, I have a contract. You signed a binding contract committing yourself, which is called a schaivus or a shibud, to pay me for my chamar, dead or alive. Therefore, you are obligated to live up to that contract. And once again, the socher retorts and says, well, you're not providing me with any services, why should I pay you for them? So let's talk about the Gemara's case. The Gemara's case is called a chocher. Again, you don't have to write this down. The chocher is the individual who receives a service. What is the service that he receives? The balabais owns a field. And he says, we'll call him Reuven, he says to Shimon, Shimon, I'm going to give you a field. You're going to work the field. You're going to produce whatever maximum produce you can produce. And a certain percentage of that produce you will pay me as payment for the service that I am offering you my field. So if I'm Reuven, the owner of the field, the balabais, I am now the maskir. You, Mr. Shimon, are the socher. And you're claiming at this point in time that the field is useless. So the first case that we have is called a flood. The water inundated the field. Hence, the field can no longer produce. And the Gemara says that the paradigm case would be a sale. Imagine the following. Reuven sells a field to Shimon, and the day after the contract is signed, Shimon is now the proud owner of this field, and the field gets inundated. In that case, Shimon takes the loss as a lone ranger, sole loss. The entire loss is his. That's called in the Gemara's language, Nistachva Sadehu. His field hasn't been inundated. Imagine, Chas V'Shalom, you own a field and it gets flooded. Who are you going to claim to? You bought the field. It's yours. You inherited it from your Alta Zeda. What are you going to do? You're going to bring the Alta Zeda back up to life and say, Zeda, why did you give me a field that was inundated? You have no claim to anybody. Now the question here is, in a case of services provided, is that equivalent to a sale? And therefore, the maskir says to the socher, or to the chocher, he's called technically in this case, look, Mr. Chocher, you bought the field, so to speak, for rental purposes. You're contractually obligated to pay, and now there's a flood that's your business. So the Gemara makes the following claim. And once again, this is a very technical, halachic principle that reads as follows, Mazlecha Goram. it's your mazel. You, Mr. Socher, rented out my field. You're going to be paying me for that field, for the use of the field, but Nebuch, the field is worthless. Well, why did it get inundated? Because you, my friend, have a very bad mazel. That's your mazel. That's your bad luck. I, Mr. Maskir, have provided you with a field. I didn't do anything to bring down the rains from the heavens or, you know, break the, shall I say, the barriers of the river, and your field is inundated. My friend, you are obligated by contract to pay me, like it or not. I don't have to provide the services unless I deliberately withhold services. But if it's a flood, which is beyond my control, my friend, that's your bad luck. So the Gemara says that that claim of Mazel Chagoram has one exception to it. And the Gemara calls that Makas Medina. And this you have to write down again. I'm sorry, I misled you if I say you only have to write down two words. Now you have to write another two words down. And that's called Makas Medina. Makas Medina means not that the field was inundated because next to the field there's a river that overflowed, but rather your field was attacked, like all the fields, with a major magefa, you know, of barad, you know, some sort of animal, you know, of creature that came down. You know, I used to live in Malé Adumim. In Malé Adumim, where I lived, every other day there was another creature that came down from, and you couldn't even see the sky. I mean, the whole sky was black, you know. So that's called Makas Medina. In the case of Makas Medina, there's no claim on behalf of the Maskir called Mazel Chagoram. The Maskir could not claim, hey, Mr. Socher, your field is inundated, you bought the field, you rented the field, you're contractually obligated. Geendik, the story is over, pay me, that's all. I can't provide the services, you know, my field is not producing bupkis, it's not producing anything. Okay. That's not my fault. That's your bad luck. But the exception, says the Gemara, is Makas Medina. In the case of Makas Medina, the entire state, the entire country, is devastated by this attack, and there is no field in the entire Medina that's producing anything. And that's called Shidafot in the Gemara's language, or Chagav. Chagav is a kind of a grasshopper that comes, massive grasshoppers, and they eat up all the produce in the fields. So now what happens? So I'm just going to dramatize this Gemara to you. Because now we've neutralized the claim of the Maskir to the Socher Mazel Chagoram. He can't point an accusing finger at the Socher. The Socher now is claiming, Mr. Maskir, I paid you for services. I meant to produce grains and fruits from your field. I cannot do so. Where are the services you're providing? The Maskir, for his part, says, well, my friend, I can't help you with this. You're contractually obligated to pay me for the schiras. So what do we do in this case? So the Gemara says, Minake es scharo. I'll try as best I can to try to interpret those words. Minake es scharo. Which means that the socher does not pay the full value of that contract. The original $10,000 is going to be reduced. And he's going to pay a slash price, a percentage of what he agreed to pay. Which means that although the socher is contractually obligated to live up to his commitment and pay, but we made a special enactment, which of course all of monetary law in Jewish law is all based on what's called Hefker Bezen Hefker, on the authority of the courts of Israel to judge and weigh every situation and make enactments and different takanos. And this takana was Menake Eschar, which means that despite the fact that the Maskir cannot provide services because of situations that are out of his control, despite the fact that the Socher is contractually obligated to pay under contract, nevertheless, we're going to lighten the burden of the Socher and I'm going to ask the maskir to share the burden of this loss. Again, the details, we don't know. We don't know if he has to pay 50%, does he have to pay less, does he have to pay more? That we don't know. What we do know is menakeh es scharo, that the maskir cannot demand from the socher full payment according to contract, because the maskir is unable to provide, again through no fault of his own, the services that were contracted. If we apply this to the case of the behemoth, in the case of the animal, we might say, well, you know, you agreed to pay me for my chamor, the chamor nebuch dropped dead, yiskal v'yiskalish, but you have to pay me by virtue of contract. But the counter argument for that would be that can the socher turn to the maskir and say, well, maybe it was you who caused the death of the animal? And of course not. That would be a ridiculous claim. If anyone is to blame, it's the socher. He's holding on to the animal, he rented it, and it's his mazel that caused the death of the animal. So in that case, the socher will pay full price based on the contract. But in the case of a makas medina, here the Gemara says that the burden will be shared by the loss will be shared by both of them, right? Each one would shoulder, give a shoulder to the loss, and therefore the maskir cannot expect to get full payment for his contract, as we would have anticipated. The socher, on the other hand, can't say, well, I'm not going to pay you a dime because I didn't get anything out of this field. You know, there's a chagav here that's attacking the field. It's a makas medina. And don't point to me with an accusing finger and say, mazel chagorim, you were the one who caused it. And therefore, nistafcha sodeu, your field was in it. They didn't know. This happened as a catastrophe that affected the entire medina. So the takana was that they both share in the loss. The maskir cannot collect full payment. The socher is not required by contract to pay the entire contract that he did. And there's going to be some sort of a compromise that's going to be worked out. So just to summarize, I wrote myself a little summary here. If the conditions make it impossible for the maskir to provide services, and the maskir now still wants to demand payment by virtue of the contract, and he's going to claim, well, this is not my fault that my field is not producing, we're going to balance two opposing claims and recognize the validity of both. And the chiddush is that the maskir, since he's not able to provide the goods, he will have to share in the loss. The socher, on the other hand, has to share in the loss because he is obligated by contract to pay for the schirus. And that's a summary of what we did until now. Okay. Now, everything that we said until now is in the Gemara in Bava Metzia and codified in the Shulchan Aruch in what we call Choshen Mishpat. And you'll see it codified here in Siman Shin Chaf Beis. Okay, fine. Now, after the Shulchan Aruch codifies what he formulates, now we have the Ramah. You know, the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, was a contemporary of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, and he writes his comments. So the Ramah quotes a Mordechai, and the Mordechai was one of the Chachmei Ashkenaz at the time the Rishonim, many centuries before the Ramah, and the Mordechai is largely based on the Maram Mirutenberg. Okay, so he was a German scholar from the Rishonim, tremendous power in the history of Psak, both for Ashkenazim and for Sfaradim as well. Very rich history during the periods of the Crusades and so forth, but that's not for us today. That's more for Tishah. Now, the Maram Mirutenberg, which you'll see here in the third paragraph, again, if you happen to have this printout, which I don't think you have, but he quotes the following situation. Okay. The Baal HaBayis, as we said before, is the one who provides the service, and he's known as the maskir. So he provided a field that's meant to produce, as we discussed. Now we get to a Bala Bais and a Melamed. And the case is that Reuven hired Shimon to teach his son, or to teach a class in a school. Now in this case, it's really a little bit tricky, but we'll try to get over this hump. The Melamed is called the Maskir, and the Bala Bais is called the Socher. Again, we go back to our original definition. The Maskir is the one who provides a service. And the, right? I'm sorry, let's start again. Right? The Maskir, yes, I got it right, is the one who provides the service. And the Socher is the one who receives the service, and he pays for it. In the case of a Melamed, the Bala Bais, again, pardon that term because it's paradoxical, but it's the Bala Bais who is now called the Socher. Why? Because the Bala Bais is going to be provided with the services of the Melamed Tinoko, so the one who's teaching his child. So in that sense, the teacher is providing services, and he's like the Bala Bais of the Sada that we spoke before in the Chocher case, and therefore he's called the Maskir. So the Melamed now becomes the Maskir. The Bala Bais is on the receiving end, receiving the benefits, the services of the Melamed, and the Bala Bais is now willing contractually to pay for those services. Says the Marami Rutenberg, the government, right, I don't want to say Yimach Shemam, but that's really what I should say. The government now came out with a decree, no teaching of Torah. It's out. Pain of death. At this point, the Melamed can no longer teach. And he's meant to provide services. He's the Maskir. The Socher, for his part, had hired him contractually to pay him for his services. Should the Socher carry the entire burden of the loss? Does the Bala Bais have to pay tuition to the Melamed, to the Maskir? And is this case identical to the case that we began with? And we should have a certain kind of a compromise, if you will, in which both the Maskir, who's meant to provide the services, and the Socher, who's contractually obligated to pay for those services, they should both share in the burden of the loss. And that's what you and I would have said until we got to the Marami Rutenberg. And the Marami Rutenberg claims that the Bala Bais carries the entire burden. He will pay the full salary. The contract remains binding. And we don't know how this is different from our case of the Socher, otherwise known as the Chocher, who claims, wait a minute, I agreed to this contract because you are providing with a field that has the productivity, the potential for productivity. It no longer has that potential for productivity. And therefore, you have to share the burden of the loss with me. Why doesn't the Bala Bais, who's the Socher in the case of hiring a teacher, have the right to say to the teacher, my friend, you have to provide services. And if you cannot provide services, then you have to chip into this loss and you have to share the burden, Joe?
Would it be different if he was to find somebody else to teach? Is this only
I'll tell you, it's at the pain of death. It's what's called a Makas Medina. Now, since you raised that question, Joe, let me go backtrack to a paragraph that I skipped. And the Gemara says the following. I provided you, we're going back to the field that I provided you, and this field has a mayan. It has a spring in the field. Or, alternatively, it has a tree, and the tree provides shade. Okay, let's focus, I don't want to get confused now, let's focus on the case of the mayan. And the Gemara says, Yavesh HaMayon V'Niktas HaIlon. The Mayan dried up. So the Gemara says, Eino menakalo mischaro. In this case, the maskir who rented out, so to speak, his field, and the socher expects to irrigate the field with this spring. The spring is now dried up. Eino menakalo mischaro. He's contractually bound, this socher, to pay the entire burden of the contract. But the Gemara gives an explanation. And the Gemara says, "Hare yochol lahavi mayim in dli min anor hagodol." Now, wait a second. What that means is, in Yiddish we call ichdaf schleppen. Instead of having the water just simply irrigate my field by opening up the mayon, I'm going to have to schlep with bucket after bucket all the way to the big river down the way, and like the water carriers of old, bring back that water. Says the Rambam, you see that Makas Medina, in which the socher has a right to be Menachem Mischaro, he could say, look, I expected services here and I'm not getting them, you know, the field is not producing. That doesn't apply in this case. Why? Because now we go back to square one. Mr. Socher, you agreed contractually to pay the schirus. And you cannot claim circumstances are beyond my control. Find a substitute. If you cannot irrigate your field from the natural spring in the field, then schlep and bring the water from the nahar. I did not guarantee you, says the maskir to the socher, that you would be able to irrigate your field with the mayon. I assumed, and I had every right to assume, that I gave you a good field with a mayon. I didn't know it would dry up during certain very extreme, you know, weather conditions or so forth and so on. But you are contractually bound. Rabosai, why do I emphasize this to you? You see over and over again that the original agreement is binding, that this halach of Makas Medina, whenever it applies, is the exception to the rule, rather than the rule. It is a special injunction that was enacted by the Chachamim to express compassion, so to speak, on behalf of the Socher, to say, well, you know, the Socher is paying for services, and he's not getting those services, so we have to take that into account. But it's a kind of way of reaching out for him. But, you know, we have a principle called Yikov Adin Sahar. I don't know if any of you get my weekly little two-minute video on the parish. If you don't, please let me know. I've been doing this now for 5 weeks. And in my video this week, I'm going to talk about this concept of Midas Adin. You know, we go by the law, the strict letter of the law. You know, the law is called Emes. It's called truth. And by way of truth, you sign the contract. You are bound to this contract. But for the sake of Makas Medina, we're going to have a little bit of compassion and make an enactment in which the maskir and the socher will share this burden. But the fascinating thing is this Maram Mirutenberg and this Mordechai that come up with this exceptional case of a Malamed and a Balabayas. And the Balabayas in this case, who is the socher, because he's paying for the services of the Malamed, who's the maskir, who's hiring out his services, he's going to have to pay the entire price, contractual, without any compassion, and forget about Makas Medina. And that's really an amazing halacha, which, by the way, would have major impact in our time on schools that have unfortunately closed because of the coronavirus. Now, there are schools, and that I'd like to talk to you about if you're interested in the next class, which are providing services from the house, you know, Zoom shiurim, recorded shiurim, telephone shiurim, etc., etc. And then the question becomes whether or not many, many other poskim will accept the position of the Marami Rutenberg that the maskir in this case is contractually bound to pay tuition, despite the fact that the Melamed is not able to provide the service for which he was contracted, and perhaps other poskim would accept the Marami Rutenberg in this case where the maskir is getting, you know, I mean to say, the maskir is providing at least, you know, some element of service in the teaching situation. Now, the Ramah quotes the following. The Maram Mipadua. Again, the Maram Mipadua is already in a later period of time. A great Italian scholar, Ashkenazi in this case, and he says that, you know what, this whole discussion about who should suffer the loss in a case of a Makas Medina, this is only relevant Lemafrea, meaning up until this moment. But from this moment and on, the deal is off. Which means that the maskir says to the socher, guess what? You're not able... Just 1 second, did I get this right? I want to see who's talking to who. Right, the socher says to the maskir, from this point and on, you're not able to provide the services which I contractually agreed to pay you for. My commitment was until this point in time, but not for the future. And I have the right to back out of the deal, mikan ulahava. Again, we see a kind of a compromise in which the halach is bending over backwards on behalf of the socher because he's not getting the services that he is paying for by contract. And we had the first kula, which is called Makas Medina Menakalo Mischara. Now we have another kula. And what we're going to say now in this case is that, you know what? The socher is saying, I hired you. You're not providing the services right now. From now on, the deal is off. The contract is batel umevutel. Which means, again, in an educational context, we basically lost the whole power of the Marami Rutenberg. What do I mean? Again, not going into detail about partial teaching. Let's say everything is closed down. There's nothing going on. We cannot organize classes on Zoom. Nothing is happening. In such a case, you know what? The socher, who's the balabais, and he is hiring the Malamed as his maskir to provide services. The socher says to the maskir, okay, my friend, I'll pay you for services not rendered by virtue of the contract, as we saw in the Marami Rutenberg, but not from now on. It's ad nauseum. I can't tolerate this situation for one more minute. I am going to be bound by a contract which cannot be fulfilled. In other words, according to the Marami Padua, we have now a kind of an ongoing contract. Every minute in its history, the contract has to be reviewed, so to speak. And although the contract up until this point was binding, but at this point, circumstances have changed radically. Because, again, my friends, imagine in a Makas Medina that the contract is binding ad infinitum. That puts the socher into an impossible situation where he's not getting the services that he's paying for. The maskir cannot provide those circumstances to no fault of his own, but the socher should now be contractually bound from here till doomsday. Can you imagine? It's September 1st, and I sign a contract to pay tuition for my child, and on September 2nd, the school closes. So I got to pay a year's worth of contract because I signed a contract. Says Rabbi Padua, no way. I'll pay you for that one day because by virtue of the contract, but not from now on. Now, I would like at this point to fast forward to some of the points that he makes here on page 3. And page 4 is, I don't know if I mentioned this to you last week, I was fascinated by this Omek HaPshat because he has a 4-page edition every week, and he finishes his whole presentation in 3 pages. The fourth page, he has these little boxes where he addresses different issues in very little short boxes. So he has an issue about toilet paper, because he says that during the corona period, people don't want to use different kinds of he calls magavot, different kinds of towels and this and that. So there's a tremendous use of, you know, disposable tissues, or disposable papers, and you just throw it out to avoid any. So there's a mass rush, you know, to buy these. So he says that there are two companies in Israel that are producing these tissues, two major companies. He tells you by name. If anybody's interested, I'll stay on afterwards. I'll tell you which names. But he says one particular company, very often, the pages are stuck, the tissue pages, paper is stuck one to the other. And he wants to claim that's a malacha on Shabbos. So avoid that company. The other company, each page is separate. Very interesting. He has another little paragraph here about outdoor events. He says a lot of outdoor events now during Corona. And he says that it's not enough to pay a mashgiach kashrus like you usually pay. You got to make sure that every single person, before he puts any food in his mouth, he checks for bugs. Because he says there are all sorts of flies and bugs that are floating around. So you need a special bedika to make sure there are no flies in your food. Then he has a little paragraph here about issues like taking a Sefer Torah out for an outdoor minyan of 10 people and bringing the Sefer Torah right back inside. I think I may have mentioned this to you in the past. I don't remember if I did or not. And he comes to a fascinating conclusion. The Shulchan Aruch says that if you have someone who's chavish bebeis ha'asurim, he's locked up in a jail, then as great as a person he is, we will not take a Sefer Torah out of its aron just simply to read the Torah for that one person. But he says that if you have 10 people in jail, then if the mountain won't come to Mohammed, then we could bring the Sefer Torah into the jail. And he says that when we have an outdoor minyan, we're all in jail. We're all in a situation where we cannot access the synagogue. And again, I know in your parts of the world, it's not so severe, and the synagogues are, Baruch Hashem, functioning. But here in Eretz Yisrael, we're having a second wave. And it's a matter of days, I think, before, I don't want to say it, I don't want to be the one to be poseach pela satan, but I think they're going to close the shuls again. I don't know. We're averaging now 1,800 positive a day. For a small country, that's a lot. So we're seeing a second wave here. There are over 100 people who are in critical condition now. So that he says that you're allowed to take the Sefer Torah out to the shul, out of the shul out to the minyan, because he says that becomes a tzibur of chavush bebeis asurim. You have an entire tzibur of people who are locked up in jail. These are all little tidbits that he has on page 4. But the basic approach here that he has in a different poskim is to work out percentages as to how much you have to pay your employees by virtue of contract when your employees cannot provide the service. He has one group of poskim that came up with a percentage called 42%, and that's the amount you have to pay. And there are another group of poskim, and he has all the names here. I mean, it's an amazing amount of research that he did, that you have to pay 50%. So that means, as we said before, there's a compromise because of Makas Medina, and we're going to split the loss. And the socher, who is claiming I'm not getting my my services provided for, will be able to pay a slash price of 50%. However, he says that there are other percentage points that kick in as well. There's something called in Bava Metzia a poel batel. Now, poel batel means that you are committed to work a certain number of hours a day, and if the work cannot be done, and it's no fault of your own, you're a laborer, then you will be paid as a poel batel. Poel batel means a certain percentage of what you paid for is simply for the work that you're doing. In other words, the sweat and toil. You would be willing to take a cut in salary if you didn't have to lift a finger. That's a poel batel. In other words, if you could just sit around, you know, like a scarecrow and protect the gardens without having to tend to them, till the soil, etc., etc., then that's worth something to you as well. So even though we may come to the conclusion that the employee is going to get paid 50% of his salary because of the contractual agreement in which the Socher committed himself, back to the Socher, I made that confusion one more time. So the Socher received services and he contractually agreed to pay for those services, but the Socher has the right to say to the Maskir, who was the Maskir, the latter was meant to provide the services, that we would subtract that percentage, which is called Kipol Batel. In other words, I don't have to pay you for services not provided. Again, I have to pay you contractually, but I can subtract from that the amount of your salary that you would not be able to demand payment for because of the fact that you're a Poel Batel. And the poskim say that that amounts to approximately 8%. Now, in addition to that, the poel, right? We said the one who provides the services, right? The employee or the maskir, he gets certain payments from the government because he cannot work. We'll call him unemployment insurance of some sort. Here it's called Bituach Lumi. Every country has some sort of payment. And he says that too has to be subtracted from the amount of money that has to be paid. So that's called Nikui Schar Kipol Botel, and as well as a certain tariff, a certain percentage, it's usually about 16% that the government is going to provide. And if that be the case, if let's say we start with 50%, we now have reduced it by 8% plus 16%, and it's probably down to about 30%, maybe even less. And what I'd like to cover with you next week is a discussion about summer camps and schools and see how this all kicks in. So if you, at least the pages that I think you do have are from Rav Shechter. We'll just, for the next few minutes as we conclude, Rav Shechter has a piece here about Avelus during the 3-week period, and he quotes Rav Soloveitchik, who bases himself on the Vilna Gaon, that even though our Avelus for Ashkenazim during the 3 weeks is based on Minog, the Minog itself has to fit into a halachic category, and a category from the 17th of Tammuz up to Rosh Chodesh Av is called Yud Beis Chodesh. It's like the period of Avelus beyond the first month for a child for a loss of a parent. The 9-day period of time, which is kicked off with Rosh Chodesh Av, is considered and defined as Shloshim, and all the laws of Shloshim will apply by virtue of this minhag. And Tisha B'Av itself is considered like Shiva, and all the laws of Shiva will apply, with the exception of two laws of Shiva, which we don't have today, and that's called Kfiyas Hamita and Atifas HaRosh. Although, again, there's a lot to talk about here, because some say that Kfiyas Hamita today means covering the mirrors. We don't have that on Tisha B'Av, and that's because we don't have what's called a base Avel on Tisha B'Av. Kfiyas Hamita is Halachim base Avel. Atifas HaRosh is a Chalashem Avel, but Avelus of what we call Avelus Yeshana of a Churban for Tisha B'Av, that's not a Chalashem Avel. That's a different halacha that the entire tzibur took upon itself, Minhagi Avelus. So he says, an Afgemina is shaving during the 3 weeks. And he says the following. With regard to someone who lost a parent during the Yud Beis Chodesh, we have a principle called Ad Sheyigaru Bo Chaverov, which means that after he dips beyond the 30 days and he still hasn't shaved or taken a haircut, so the halacha says that we wait a period of time until his friends will sort of jeer him on, you know, you're looking a little bit schlumpedick. But Rav Moshe Feinstein claims that in our time, it means that we wait double the period of one haircut to the other. So let's say, for example, you take a haircut every 6 weeks. I'm just throwing out a number. So then when you get to week 12 weeks, that would be Ad Sheyigaru Bo Chaverov automatically. And if you take a haircut every 5 weeks, then 1 week past Shloshim would already be Ad Sheyigaru Bo Chaverov, and you're allowed to take a haircut and a shave. He says that for those who shave on a weekly basis, once a week, then the time will be considerably shorter than, let's say, between one haircut and the other, which might be as much as 2 months or 3 months. But here he takes a shave every week. And therefore he says that during the three-week period, based on Rav Soloveitchik, he says that there'd be a lot more room for leniency to shave during the 3 weeks for someone who shaves on a weekly basis, because he doesn't allow a full week to go by without shaving. If somebody shaves on a daily basis, he would not allow a day to go by without shaving. Now, if that's the halacha that applies to Ad Sheyigaru Bo Chaverov in Yud Beis Chodesh, we're going to superimpose that halacha on the dry vachin, and therefore it's very conceivable that you'd allow a person to shave almost daily during the 3 weeks. It's a big, big kula. And as far as music is concerned during the 3 weeks, so although it's true that Yud Beis Chodesh, in the case of Aviv V'Imo, by virtue of Minog, enjoins the Avel from listening to music, but he says, Mishu b'matzav shel mora shchora v'atzvus, right, during this period, if those who are quarantined are living through very difficult times, and he's not listening to music just simply because he's in a hoopla mood to enjoy the music, but rather lefakeches atzmuso me'olav, to somehow mitigate the depression, he says, that was never included in the original minhag. The minhag was to prohibit music for the sake of pure pleasure and enjoyment. And he writes, ka'es, and he adds here Tammuz, because again the story changes from month to month. Shekola olam shori bitzar machmas hamagefa sheposhtu b'chola olam harbe shriyim b'mara shchori. He says it's very common to find people in a very state of tension, and therefore yesh lahakil bozeh, and to allow the listening of music, because that's not the music that we accepted by minute. Now, you may have had a piece called Tfilos B'Beis HaKnesses B'Rosh Hashanah, and he says that Amir Tzashem, if we go back to the shuls for Rosh Hashanah, here in Israel, no one's willing to predict that we'll be back in shuls for Rosh Hashanah, and shofar is going to be a major issue, but he has a different issue here, and he wants to suggest the following. He says that let's say there's only room in the shul for 1 minyan, and they will not allow so many people to fill up all the seats, and everybody wants to come to shul for Rosh Hashanah, halavai. He says, we're going to make 2 minyanim, one after the other. The first minyan, which he calls a minyan of hashkama, he sets it for 7 a.m. I don't know exactly why it has to be 7, but let's say in America, hashkama minyan is at 7. 7 is actually particularly early. And I don't know if at Rosh Hashanah time you can daven much before 7, except maybe. Anyway, he says the regular minyan is going to start at 9. That gives you 2 hours for Rosh Hashanah minyan. So Rav Shechter writes an entire tshuva. What is critical? What do we have to fit into that 2 hour period of davening, so that the first minyan would be over and the second minyan could take over? he says we're going to have to omit the piyut. The piyut. He says there's one piyut he's not willing to omit because he thinks it dates back to the time, perhaps, of the Beis HaMikdash itself. And that is, just let me read it to you. He says that there's a piyut called Ha'ochez Biyad Midas Mishpat. I forgot, what's the next line? There's this... I'll open up the Maser.
Kelarichti.
He's going to leave out for Chol Maminim. He wants to know about Unasana Tokef. And he writes that Im Yirtzu Lomar Unasana Tokef, if they absolutely push for it, he says, Arashus B'yadam, we'll let them get away with it, but he says it's not the most chashuv piyut. It's not the most important piyut. I think he doesn't spell out why. I think he means because it's a much later piyut. You know, we have piyutim that date back to the time of the Rishonim. And he says the following, that although we may be very sad about leaving out all the piyutim of Rosh Hashanah, I mean, that's what gives, you know, the Rosh Hashanah davening such a powerful emotional impact, but he says that Bizmanim Ageifa Shadayin Kol Olam Shoreres B'Mageifa, he says Yesh Shas Hadchak Golol, and he says based on the Noda B'Yehuda, which Rav Shechter quotes all the time, it's another work of the Noda B'Yehuda called the Dugal Mirvava, we don't have to be Mater Neder in a case of Shas Hadchak, meaning every minog which we accept and has the power of a neder, we have to be matir neder, with the exception of a situation in which we can determine that the original minog was limited and didn't apply in this case. And he says that the minog of piyutim was accepted shelo b'shas hadchak, but b'shas hadchak we never accepted the minog. And he says that in order to guarantee that we could finish the entire davening by 9 o'clock, we're going to have to also cut down the tekios. Now here we're getting on, you know, once you play with the tekios, you're getting into, you know, very shaky ground here. And he says, number one, we don't have to be makpid on the minhag of mea kolos, of 100 kolos, you know, with Aim Cicero and all that. He says, Zeh eino midina, that's not according to the strict letter of the law, elmi minog. And again, the minog doesn't apply to Shas Hadchak. And once again, he says, you don't have to be matir ned. He doesn't spell out exactly how many tekios you need. My guess is you need 60 tekios, which means 34 what's called tekios to miyushav, which is before we start the Shmon Esrei, and another 30, 10, 10, and 10, which is spliced into the Musaf service. I don't know, he doesn't go into detail. As far as Psuke the Zimra is concerned, he says that people should stay home, but he's nervous about that. Because if you stay home for Psuke the Zimra, then he says that there may be a hefsek in a bracha. Every Psuke the Zimra opens up with a bracha. And if you come for Shochein Ad or HaMelech, then your walking to the shul is itself a hefsek. The ein zeh nachon. He's mamish in the middle of a bracha. And he tells a story about his father. Right? His father was Rav Melech Shechter. And he learned in a yeshiva in Europe called Vizhnitz as a youth. And the Vizhnitz Rebbe, who was the Shliach Tzibur, would begin with a special niggun for Nishmas Kol Chai. And he says that that was the Tchilas HaBrocha. Now I'm not sure what he means that that was the Tchilas HaBrocha. So I'm going to have to clarify that for you. He's got a little bit of a summary here in English, but he doesn't even mention this story about Vizhnitz. So I honestly can't tell you what he means. I'll read it once more. He says, "Arevi shimesh keshatz b'shabbes v'yamaschil b'nigun miyuchad mitchilas nishmas shezet tchilas habracha." I don't know what he means. I suspect, but I'm afraid to even say it out loud, that maybe the bracha of Baruch Sha'amar, they waited and they delayed until nishmas. I don't know, but that would certainly certainly solve that problem. Now, what you may have also received is a very long piece from Rav Shechter called Binyanei Tefillah. I think it's close to 10 pages long. And I think maybe what we should do is, I'll do this homework and try to decide, pick and choose, which of these sections are critical for us or very important for us to know as we move forward. Again, let me reiterate what I said at the beginning of this year. If you'd like to get to Mar Makomos beforehand, send me an email, azariaberzon@gmail.com. I'll pass on your name with his permission, with your email, to David Spiegel, and he'll send it out to you, God willing. I would like to, on the second round, continue with some of these monetary issues and also the issue of having a test for corona on a Friday, which may be lifneiver, you're causing someone to violate the Shabbos. And all that is in this journal that comes out once a week called Omek HaPshat, which you can get online. I'll try to send you a link, which I tried, but it didn't happen, I don't think. I don't know, maybe it did. So that's it for now, and